I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There is one absolutely wonderful exhibit. Well, there are always wonderful exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum, but this is the Ebony Fashion Fair. It's costumes from this fair, which traveled around the country displaying high fashion for many, many years. The exhibit itself is titled Inspiring Beauty, 50 Years of Ebony Fashion Fair. It opened earlier in February. It's organized by the Chicago History Museum in cooperation with Johnson Publishing Company, a very important company, and we'll find out why this hour. It's a retrospective on the 50-year history of this fashion spectacle that also raised a lot of money for charity, and it redefined the concepts of beauty, style, and empowerment, and you can see how that's the case when you go through this exhibit for African Americans through the Ebony Fashion Fair. There are all kinds of beautiful costumes, outrageous costumes, important costumes, which explore the history of this fashion show and the powerful woman who founded, directed, and produced the shows, Eunice Walker Johnson. It's presented in three sections. We're going to be talking about it and all the issues that are related to fashion, and there are many with our two guests this hour. Camille Morgan is with us, both our guests in our Milwaukee studios. She's an independent curator and an arts administrator. Her focus is stemming from her background in fashion business and studies in museums and galleries. She blends contemporary art with fashion objects and theory, exploring their place in society at large, especially within the overlapping spheres of race, ethnicity, and gender. She has been the guest coordinating curator for the Inspiring Beauty 50 Years of Ebony Fashion Fair that's now at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and we are delighted to have you with us, and I wish it were television because the women with us really, I don't, but they really know how to dress. So when I said to KP, bring a camera, you got to have a camera for our guests this hour because they know fashion. Thank you so much, Camille, for being with us. And it's such a great show. I must tell you that, you know, I wore blue jeans for most of my life and I don't understand fashion, but I just thought this was a terrific show. I got a great kick out of it and I realized how important, and I never thought this before, how important fashion can be.
Well, absolutely. I think about fashion every day. I have since I was a little kid.
Really?
And I see it in everything. It's kind of like the way I can understand history and economics, sociology, philosophy. It's really a great window for me to just explore different, you know, different parts of our society. And that's why I love being a curator of fashion and material culture, because I can also share that with other people.
Yeah, well, you've done a brilliant job.
Thank you.
Kaiser is also with us, and there's a very interesting connection between Mount Mary University in Milwaukee and this exhibit and Mount Mary in fashion. She is chair of the fashion department and associate professor of fashion at Mount Mary, and she represents the department in all kinds of efforts, the university's current collaboration with the Milwaukee Art Museum, and we'll talk about what that is. She launched the department's internship program. She grew the annual student designer fashion show. She coordinates study tours to New York and Paris, and she's a curriculum consultant for programs all over the country. She's a design educator. She has co-authored two fashion textbooks, and this summer she's coordinating a two-week salon in Paris entitled Nurturing the Creative Spirit. And thank you so much, Sandra, for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's start with, as the exhibit does, with the founder of this fashion show, who was such an important African-American woman, and you could see right off the bat what she was doing when she had these fashion shows, but she was a powerhouse and a woman, I think her daughter has said, who was way ahead of her time in terms of being a powerful black woman in America.
I completely agree. The work that Eunice Johnson did in bringing these haute couture fashions to black communities and just many people across the United States for 50 years. The fact that she kept it going for 50 years is what really impresses me. It started out as a philanthropic effort in New Orleans for the Flint Goodrich Hospital, which was one of the first black-owned, black-run hospitals in the United States. So this is 1956 we're talking about. And they wanted to do a fundraising effort for the hospital to raise money. At that time in the country, it was one of the only places where blacks could get health care, and they could offer health care, they said, as little as a penny a day. So they definitely needed to raise money. So they worked with Johnson Publishing Company, and everyone that came to the fashion show got a free subscription to Ebony Magazine for a year, or a six-month subscription to Jet. So it was a great marketing effort. And Eunice Johnson had such a great time doing it that she thought, okay, we'll have the fashion editorial, but we'll take it outside of the pages of the magazine and bring it to people all across the country.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that when she was starting all these efforts, you didn't see very many brown or black women on the runway, nor did you see many designers who were brown and black.
Absolutely not. When she began, I mean, there were always, you know, black philanthropic organizations that would do fashion show fundraisers. That was a really popular way to raise money back then, and still to this day. But what she wanted to do was bring these high fashions that she had access to because of her background, her class, her wealth, to people that wouldn't normally be able to see them, and then put them on brown and black bodies. But even when she went to Europe to get these fashions, they didn't want to sell to her. First, they didn't want to let her borrow anything, and then they definitely didn't want to sell to her because they thought their clientele would be put off by seeing their clothes on not the right kind of person. But she persevered, and at the height of the fashion fair, she was spending upwards of $1 million a year on haute couture and designer clothes for all of her models and to bring across the United States.
Mm. And where does this collection come from? Where did you get all of these clothes?
Well, the clothes that you see in the exhibition, we actually have them from two places. So everything you see, walk the Ebony Fashion Fair runway, and if you see, like, for instance, there's a Dior coat from 1964, that's
beautiful.
The year it walked the runway, right?
Mm.
So Johnson Publishing Company, since Eunice actually bought all of these clothes, they owned them, right? So it's like 5,000 plus costumes. But then once we get to 2011, 2013, they start having to auction some off because they just don't have the capability to keep and care for them. Because, you know, fashion conservation is a very specialized field, and they're, at the end of the day, they were a publishing company, so they didn't really have the assets to be able to take care of it. And then that's how we actually got 13 garments from Mount Mary University, because they also purchased 23 garments at auction.
And Mount Mary has something like 10,000 items, historical collection.
We do.
Oh, goodness gracious.
We've been collecting pretty much ever since the fashion department started. And what's serendipitous about this exhibition is that it's a 50-year anniversary of the Mount Mary fashion department. So we're celebrating 50 years, just like the Ebony Fashion Show. We were the first four-year fashion program in the country. And it was all started by a school sister of Notre Dame, Sister Mary Eloise Hesburgh. And she got lots of good advice from designers in New York, most memorably Charles Kleibacher, and he said, you've got to start collecting fashion. Students have to see really good clothes. So we started collecting fashion way back in the 60s, but when we had an opportunity to purchase some of the clothes at auction, the designers that we purchased are designers who weren't worn in Milwaukee, that they weren't sold in Milwaukee. So it gave us an opportunity to give a whole new perspective to our collection, to represent designers that we otherwise wouldn't have access to.
I must ask, because there is a picture that caught our attention at the end of the show with a nun who's sitting with other nuns at a runway with models walking down the runway, and you look at it, you say, how in the world did nuns who in those years wore habits, they didn't wear outfits, they wore the same thing every single day. How in the world did they become so interested in fashion?
Well, the administration at the time wanted a major that would really capture the community's attention. And several people on our board of directors decided that fashion was it. There was a lot of industry in the Wisconsin and specifically Milwaukee area. They all said, yeah, we'd love it if there was a fashion major that was grounded in the liberal arts, not just a two-year school. And so that's how we launched. And there were two people, Eileen Ryan Ryan, who was the fashion editor for the Milwaukee Journal, and Lynn Skeen of Zygmunt Joseph & Skeen, a big public relations office. And they suggested that if we were going to be credible, we had to have designer input from New York. So we always had in those early years someone in New York that would work with us, and then they gave Sister access to the collections in New York. One of them was the Rudy Gernreich show, which is when he introduced the topless bathing suit. So there are many stories.
Of course, the topless bathing suit. Oh, there are a lot of stories. Let's go to the... You were saying something when you took us on a tour of this wonderful exhibit. About the fact that color was not a part of African-American wardrobe, particularly in slave years. There tended to be a tendency to wear drab things so that you wouldn't attract any kind of attention. Is some of the color and the gorgeous color, outstanding color we see in this exhibit in almost every single costume, a reflection of the fact that people were trying to break as far as they could from that past of oppression?
Yeah, definitely. Eunice, she definitely didn't want to be hemmed in by any societal ideas that she didn't agree with. I mean, that's partially why I think the show and the costumes we see are so surreal. I mean, even looking at what's in the show, I feel like I still don't see anything like that today, necessarily. And what she wanted to do was really set her models apart and show elements of black style that you weren't seeing in the media. So putting like really bright yellows, bright reds, bright purples on some of her darkest models made a really bold statement, and it encouraged people to not be afraid of color. And even when I, you know, talk about it on the gallery tours, no one can believe that people wouldn't think that these bright colors would look great on darker skin tones. But there was a time in history when blacks were meant to be you weren't meant to be seen or heard. You were working in the background. You were working in maybe low-wage jobs. But what's also bizarre is that at the same time, you have, like I said, black-owned hospitals. You know, Eunice Johnson was born to a black surgeon, and her mother was an educator. So there's this bizarre notion happening where you have really high-achieving African-Americans, but there's still this idea of, okay, maybe they can have their own company or their own hospital. There's still this segregation happening. So by putting models, you know, in these really bright colors, she wanted to visually just stamp that out and make you stand out. People couldn't take their eyes off of you if you walked into a room. Which,
absolutely.
You know, it's like a point of survival, too, for blacks
right.
in business and wherever.
When you go through the show, it makes you wonder why in the world you'd wear anything but that wasn't that kind of color, because it's fun and it is absolutely beautiful, just beautiful. I want to talk about the world of fashion for a moment, because I'm wondering, I don't know very much about it, to tell you the truth, and I've always been, you know, I go to resale shops and I just don't, I don't have a sense of it. I'm not artistic. I can't draw. I can't do any of that. So it's hard for me to even buy anything, and I don't know what looks good and what doesn't look good because I don't have that sense. But you realize when you see this show that I think like I've been overlooking an important part of life, that obviously fashion makes huge statements about who you are and what you want to let people know about who you are and what your place should be and the power that you hold. It's really an extension of so many things, isn't it?
There was a wonderful book at one time, still out there, by Alison Lurie, and it was called The Language of Fashion. And she started it out by saying that before you get close enough to see me or speak to me or know who I am, you see my clothes and you make certain
yes.
assumptions about who I am. And I think that is so true, perhaps even more true today, because life moves so quickly. And we see so many people in the course of a day that we don't really have time to interact with. And so people are making judgments, like it or not, about how we present ourselves all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. I was just thinking of Veblen's theory of conspicuous consumption. And that's kind of like this philosophy that we learn about in our fashion studies. And it talks about ideas of class and your clothing. So if you are looking to move into another class level, or you're trying to imagine yourself into a higher class level, you will specifically purchase things that maybe you can't afford, or they look like a certain trend that you're seeing the upper echelons of society, or, I mean, today I guess it would be like pop stars or people that are really, you know, in the public like that, to get that sort of look so you could present yourself in a way that you might not have, you might not actually be living at that time. It's
interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And fast fashion makes that so much more possible today, because they're able to copy what we see on the runways, sometimes put it out in the stores before the designer actually gets what they showed on the runway into their retail establishment. So it's really an interesting world. Fashion can be replicated so quickly by those who are really good at it, that we can get something that looks like runway fashion at very affordable prices.
And was that the case in the early years of the Ebony Fashion Show as well, or were these one of a kind and they always pretty much stayed one of a kind, or did they influence what you would see on other people?
Well, I mean, kind of both. So when Eunice Johnson would be putting these, like I said, custom haute couture garments on her models that cost, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, like even in the 50s and 60s, she would turn around and say, okay, well, if you're in the audience and you're seeing these amazing clothes and you know you don't have, you know, $50,000 lying around and time for custom fittings, here's how you can get the look for less. And so she would really play up that aspect in the fashion, you know, editorials. And it's still something you see today. In fact, I think there was a weird reality show called The Look for Less on...
Oh, really?
I don't know what channel it was on, but it's something that I think you see through, especially like Zara or H&M, Target. The quality isn't obviously there,
right,
but there's some decent things you can find if you know how to, you know, look at the inside of clothing and look at seams. You could make some pretty good choices.
Do you know how to do all that? Look at seams.
I do.
Do.
That's why no one likes to go shopping with me. I spend hours.
Oh, I think everybody would want to go shopping with you. Really, they don't want.
Actually, no, people do want to go shopping.
Yeah.
I go shopping by myself for myself.
Okay,
because no one can take that time.
The booklet, the beautiful booklet that accompanies this show, has a chapter on the meaning of style in African-American life. And this is said, clothing is never just about commanding respect. Dressing up also a source of pleasure. The ability to improvise, to think on one's feet, and make creative magic in the moment is a highly valued across the realms of African-American culture. I wanted you to respond to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes me think of... there's like these theories we learn in school, like trickle up and trickle down theory. And oftentimes, so that meant, for instance, like blue jeans became more, you know, popular and sought after, and just you see very expensive blue jeans now. But, you know, at first they were clothing that your working class people would be wearing, farmers, people that had to work outside. They needed a hardy fabric, mm-hmm. like a heavy mm-hmm. sort of twill to keep, you know, to protect themselves when they're outside working. So when I think about trickle up and trickle down, my mind goes to like Madonna, because she has that look that was popularized in the 80s with like the tulle skirt and all the beads and everything. And she didn't make up that style, but she popularized it. She found that in lower class, you know, ghettos and areas of New York City in the 80s. And so the people that were making up their own style, because they're working with whatever they have around them. And when you have a little, you know, you have little resources, you can be really, you have to be really imaginative if you have the impulse to want to feel good about yourself and look good when you go out and have that pride. And you see that in African-American culture going back to slave times. Maybe they would get a very small amount of clothes from their master for the whole year, but what they would do is still be able to go, you know, to the markets maybe on Sundays, or get hand-me-downs from the people that lived in the big house on the, you know, the property that they were slaving on, because
right.
they were not getting paid,
right.
not working. But, and they would be very, you know, creative with what they could make and, still wanted to feel that, you know, pride in themselves when they would have their parties or go out to church when they had little freedoms here and there. I mean, very little. But I think that's something, I mean, people still do today. If you work in the arts, you don't necessarily make a great deal of money, so you will go to the thrift store, you will go to that vintage store, TJ Maxx, wherever. I don't say no to anything. And you could really make an outfit that looks good on you, which is, I think, the key. Fits you well.
I think fashion is really a tightrope because we wear certain things because we want to fit in and conform, and that's especially true with teenagers and young adults, but we also want to make it our own, and this generation in particular is very independent, and so they're into styling, they're into high-low mixing, getting something at a vintage store and then getting something new and mixing it up so that they make it their own look, and I think that crosses, that's a diverse response to fashion, that you want to fit in, but you also don't want to be seen coming and going.
Do you have like a philosophy of the design program at Mount Mary? You're teaching your students to become what?
Well, we're teaching our students, we are very lucky in Milwaukee to have a lot of industry. More design right now, or design jobs, come from big retailers who design their own private label brands. And so we're lucky enough to have Bon-Ton, which owns Boston Store. They have a product development headquarters here. Kohl's, we have Jockey International, we have Harley Davidson Motor Clothes, not too far away, we have Land's End. So we have a lot of industry here. Our philosophy is to, for the most part, to teach students to be ready to go into corporate types of jobs. But those students who aren't interested in corporate, they also will have the skill set to have their own businesses. And entrepreneurship is also very important in this generation. Many of them have seen parents lose jobs in corporations, and so they have a very entrepreneurial spirit, and sometimes they try to balance both. And with Etsy and all the opportunities to sell your things online, that's very possible.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and here's how you can reach our conversation today. I hope that we'll hear from some of you who have already seen the show, because if you've seen the show, you have things you want to say about this show. It stays with you. Inspiring Beauty, 50 years of Ebony Fashion Fair. It's at the Milwaukee Art Museum, organized by the Chicago History Museum in cooperation with Johnson Publishing Company, a retrospective of the 50-year history of this fashion show, and it was a charity fashion show that has been so important, particularly for African Americans and for designers and for women in America, actually, and beyond the world of fashion. We welcome your calls, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Camille Morgan is the curator of the exhibit. She is with us, and Sandra Kaiser, who is chair of the fashion department at Mount Mary University, are in our studios here in Milwaukee. Here's our number again, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. If you haven't had a chance to see this exhibit yet, I'm sure that many of, well, we all get dressed every day, I think. And so you have thoughts about fashion in your own life, or fashions that you've lived through, or the importance of fashion in your life, or the importance of fashion in various communities, women in fashion. I thought what Sandra said was interesting, that before people have a chance to find out who you are as a human being, they do look at how you're put together and what kind of statements are you making, and do you spend much time in your life on fashion or much money on fashion? Well, we'd just like to hear from you. Give us a call. 800-486-8655, and we'll be with you momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, we have two really interesting shows. During the first hour of our program, we'll be talking with the last four Wisconsin Teachers of the Year, and we'll be discussing how teaching in classrooms have changed over the past 4 years since Act 10 was put in place, how many people are entering the profession, the importance of teaching. All of that will be hour one of our program tomorrow. We hope you will listen and call in. Hour two of our show, an author who's been working on dog shelters, sustainable food, and she is the author of The Painted Pilgrim, which is a children's book about a large, shockingly pink dog who shows up at the door of the Give Me Shelter dog shelter. So we'll talk about dog shelters and how everyone, needs a home. You got to listen to that one as well. All right, let's go to phone calls. Anybody who's seen the show, we would love to hear your response to it. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to see it. First of all, it's the Art Museum, which is just about the darn prettiest place in the city, and it's just a terrific show. I know you're going to like it. We go to Sandra in Milwaukee first. Hi, Sandra. Sandra.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Sandra. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I did see the show. I am certainly no fashionista, but I did in the 50s and 60s sew a lot of my own clothes. Right now, I don't think I could see the thread and needle, but I just remembered the beauty of tailoring from that time. And there is, at the beginning of the exhibit, a very simple blue suit. I believe it was Mrs. Johnson's own suit. Mm-hmm. And it is just a gorgeous work of art. And I just really urge there are much more fantastic outfits throughout the thing, but just bringing back that sense of tailoring is really wonderful. And many, many beautiful fashions.
Sandra,
I'm a person who wears jeans and a sweatshirt now, but I enjoyed every minute of it, so I recommend it to everybody.
Sandra, when you were sewing for yourself and going out or going to work, how did you want to present yourself in the world?
I started in the 50s when it was a, pretty conservative suit kind of thing, and then sort of into the 60s, I was a lawyer, but I would still wear mini skirts to court.
Really?
And things were a little less conservative then. But in terms of style, I just think whichever kind of style, whether it was conservative or there's one outfit that's just made out of some kind of... it makes the model look sort of like a bird, but in a very good way. It was just gorgeous. The use of, the various use of fabrics was just wonderful.
Right.
And, whether they have some very conservative clothes and some that are absolutely outrageously
yes.
gorgeous.
Right.
A lovely show.
Yeah, I think so, too. A lovely show. You made mention, Camille, of that suit that Eunice Johnson wore and how
yeah.
beautiful the suit was. Why?
I really wanted to... Well, that suit is at the very beginning of the exhibition because it represents the only outfit in the show that Eunice Johnson wore. So that mannequin has no head, it has no feet, it has no legs. We really wanted to show her as a singular figure in front of the fashion fair and put her out sort of in front of her army of beautiful black and brown models because she really did make the show something that no one had ever seen before. She was basically the brains behind it. And it's just, I think it's representative of her business acumen. It's very simple. It's just made of linen. It's a beautiful blue, like a bright blue linen Pauline Trigère day suit. And she's actually pictured wearing it on the inaugural tour of the Johnson Publishing Company building in Chicago in the South Loop. And so it's also important to show that this being the first black-designed, black-owned, black-commissioned business building in the United States at the time. So it opened in 1972, and she's wearing this at the inaugural, tour of it, and she has a beautiful little gold brooch on with this dress. I think it just represents the beginning of a new era for fashion and black and brown women, in fashion.
Absolutely.
And the opportunity for Mount Mary to get involved in this exhibit, it meshed nicely because what we were picking out at auction were more tailored garments, things that the students might use as inspiration every day. And while we do special occasion wear, the brunt of what they're designing is for everyday wear. And so when Camille and the rest of the staff at the Art Museum came over to see our 22 pieces, it was really a nice mesh, because obviously the traveling exhibit concentrates on that evening wear. We were able to supply a little bit more of the day wear.
Right.
And these are pieces that only Milwaukee audiences will get to see. Milwaukee was wisely took the whole exhibit. Some cities where it's touring, they're not showing everything. Milwaukee shows the whole 75, 79 piece exhibit that's traveling, plus our 13. So it's a really wonderful, rich combination.
And Mount Mary had the fashion show on its campus, didn't they, for some years?
For 4 years. We were using a choreographer, Florida Perry Smith. She's well known to audiences around town. And she was choreographing our student designer fashion show each year. She was very active in the Cream City Links and asked if Mount Mary wouldn't host the fashion show. So in 1996, 97, 98, and 2001, The show was on our campus. And I can tell you that I was there both on our campus and at the Pabst Pabst Theater, and it was just amazing to go to. The people dressed to the nines,
They're
such an interactive audience. They hooted and hollered, and the choreography was very interactive. The male models would flirt with the female models, and you can just imagine, but it was a really uplifting, fun event to go to.
I would imagine. I'm sorry that I haven't seen one. I would love to see one as well. I want to talk about the designers for a moment, too, because, I mean, some of these people, I can't pronounce their names, so you'll have to help me out with this. But how people rise to the top of the profession, and I was interested in the whole Fashion Week took place in New York the week before last, and the Times had an article about the lack of African-American designers, that out of something like 400-something pieces, there were 12 designed by African-Americans. When you look at the rich history of what we're seeing at the Art Museum and what you're looking today on looking at today on the runways of New York City, something's jarring here, isn't it?
Yeah, like a real disconnect.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that I always think about, and I always wonder. I think, okay, Eunice Johnson did this show for 50 years. I got Ebony and Jet at home. I know all my friends saw that. We all saw the fashion and the potential of, you know, what you could do, but when it came time for me to go to college, my parents were like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, oh, well, I love fashion. I want to do something in that. And they were like, well, what are you going to do in fashion? And I was like, well, there must be a lot to do. Let me look at, you know, let me research, you know, summer programs for people in high school to learn about fashion. And I know, Mount Mary, don't you guys have some sort of summer program where kids can learn about the industry, right?
Absolutely. We have a summer camp to introduce people to both the skill sets and the jobs. And the Art Museum and Mount Mary are collaborating this Saturday with a program where 200 middle school children will go both to the Art Museum and have some activities there, and then they'll travel to Mount Mary University to learn a little bit about fashion careers. But I think what happens is the cost of entry at that level to have a fashion show, to have a showroom, to have workers who can make those garments, because you don't do it all by yourself. And I think the cost of entry precludes a lot of people from getting in. And I think that's really unfortunate, because we know that talented designers come in all races and colors.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And don't necessarily go to college. I mean, they maybe start out apprenticing and learning from someone else that's much more skilled. I mean, I feel like in France, the industry is so much more protected than it is in the United States with their governing body, the La Chambre des Syndicale de l'Haute Couture Proporté. So it's like this group.
What in the world is that? It's just rolled off your tongue. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's like this. I imagine they. Well, no, I shouldn't talk about The Simpsons here. We're talking about fashion, but I imagine this is a group of people that meet and they talk about how we can protect this industry. In France, I mean, when you think about fashion capitals, you think of Paris is usually the first one everyone says. And there's a reason for that. It has a long history of really high, complicated fashion and their haute couture industry is, it's very protected.
To show in the haute couture, you have to be a member or an invited designer.
I see.
And you have to have a workroom of so many petite small hands that make your garments. You have to show twice a year. You have to have so many garments in each collection. And it's very, very expensive to do all that. So there are rules. And what we see now, because we're often in Paris for the couture collections, is there are very few names left that you really recognize in the haute couture. Mm-hmm. A lot of designers are only showing ready-to-wear because it's really so expensive.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine. So finish your story. So your parents said, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and they said, what are you going to do? And I mean, I think the reason why there aren't more brown and black people in the fashion industry is simply because they don't know it's an option. It's definitely... There's the whole, when people think of fashion, they say, oh, you went to school to study fashion merchandising and marketing. What are you going to make for me? And I was like, well, I make spreadsheets because there's this whole business side of fashion that, I mean, people can go on to get their MBAs and, you know, be a buyer, be someone that handles marketing for a fashion label or, you know, a larger company like, you know, Macy's or where was that, Federated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, like, forgetting some of my fashion school information. But these are viable options, and I think families don't think, oh, well, I don't want to send my kid to school to study fashion because what are they going to necessarily do with that unless they're a very famous fashion designer, which we were just talking about. It's hard to, you know, really make a name for
right.
yourself. And even the African-American designers that we have on display in the exhibition, let's see, we have Patrick Kelly. I mean, he passed away when he was 35, but he was really prolific during just like the 10 years he was designing.
Stephen Burroughs.
Yeah, Stephen Burroughs, B. Michael. B. Michael has a line right now at Macy's called, like, I think it's Red, B. Michael Red or something.
Hmm.
But these are names, like, when I was in fashion school, we did not learn about African-American designers. I did not learn about one African-American designer in 4 years of fashion school. So it's another thing where it's like, are the educators knowing more information about things that live outside of just, you know, European fashion? I mean, there's African fashion weeks. There's fashion weeks going on in Asia, South America, all over the world, but the curriculum tends to focus a fashion history that looks solely at Europe because we're in the United States and so our connection. But the United States is a really diverse place, right? So, you know, what's going on with fashion weeks in Mexico or anywhere else in the world? And that's something that I had to explore on my own after undergrad.
Interesting.
And kind of explore that, yeah.
Well, it's great. It's interesting that both of you have been able to fashion these incredible careers in this whole industry, too. You must have made your parents proud.
I think so. I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I started out working in fashion business. I worked for Ralph Lauren Children's Wear for a few years
in
New York. Yeah, and it was just like The Devil Wears Prada. That movie is for real, you guys. It's a completely, I mean, it's like an exhilarating industry, but also very... catty. I don't know. What do you say, Sandy? Do you think it's like that in the industry?
You have to be very strong because criticism isn't always gentle in fashion. And so you have to really believe in what you're doing. You have to be able to separate the valid criticism from that's just being nasty. And if you believe in what you're doing, you have to find the customer that also believes and keep doing it. But it's not easy. And many a designer has gotten to a certain level where they thought, if I just had a little bit more investment, and they've sold their name to a big company, and pretty soon you hear that they're leaving their own company, their namesake, because they couldn't work in the climate, the culture, where it was so big.
I see.
So
yeah.
It's really, again, this tightrope of how big do you want to get?
Yeah, it's kind of like finding your niche in it, you know. I've combined it with contemporary art because I wanted to explore the meaning of fashion and, you know, material culture
through
other guises. So it worked out for me. I'd never thought about being a curator growing up ever, and here I am. So
right.
It's something anyone can do.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. We welcome more phone calls. Sandra, thanks very much for yours. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we're talking about the wonderful show that is at the Milwaukee Art Museum right now. It's the Ebony Fashion Show, which was on the road to so many cities for 50 years. It's titled Inspiring Beauty, 50 Years of Ebony Fashion Fair Travels to Milwaukee. And the outfits are absolutely stunning and very, very colorful. Camille Morgan is the independent curator and arts administrator, and Sandra Kaiser is the chair of the fashion department at Mount Mary University. They have a collection. Some of their collections from the Ebony Show are in this show, and they also have this incredible design program and huge collection of historic outfits. So give us a ring if you would like. 800-486-8655. Sandra called and said she had attended one of these fashion fairs, and our Sandra has, of course, been to one as well because Mount Mary hosted some of them. If you have been to any of those, we'd love to hear what your impressions were. If you have seen the exhibit, we'd love to hear what your impressions are. So we'll go back to phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two more phone calls for our guest. Margie in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I had just turned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, so haven't heard a lot of it. But it's very interesting. I took some undergraduate fashion classes years ago, but I ended up majoring in foods. And part of it was because I didn't think I had I could handle the criticism and things like that. So that I could understand. But if it's that unusual or difficult for women or students of color to think about this field, have you ever thought about taking some kind of a presentation onto campuses, especially the black colleges, or just to get some dialogue talking on campus?
Well, I think there's a lot of interest in fashion across all races. So the interest isn't the problem, and many, many students complete their education and are working in the industry. If you would go to Kohl's Corporate right here in Milwaukee, you would see a very diverse group of people as designers, technical designers, buyers, etc. I think the issue that both Camille and I were getting to is the fact that it is hard for anyone to raise to the ranks of a well-known design label.
Sure.
Our claim to fame is Donna Rico, and many of you may know that Donna Rico name, but it's actually in the better price point. It's not at the designer price point. So, and to tell you the truth, that's oftentimes a more profitable place to be, because the market that can afford to buy designer goods, and certainly the market that buys couture goods, is very, very small.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
Yeah, they say there's, 20 women a year that can even afford to buy.
Oh, my gosh. Are you serious?
Yeah, because that involves several fittings and all sorts of, the petite main, the small hands work that takes hundreds of hours to, put into one garment. So, I mean, that's why you'll see there are a lot of designers in the show that have actually licensed their name to all sorts of products. Halston kind of decimated his brand by licensing out to just several people. Pierre Cardin, the same thing, but then the show is great because you see some of their original design ideas represented, and at the end of the day, I feel like that's who they really were, regardless of being able to license their name out. But with regards to bringing the idea that fashion is a viable industry to go into to children or different groups, I consider that I still work in fashion, even though I work in contemporary art because my focus is fashion. But I know there are museum and gallery programs that are looking specifically at minority populations to offer internships to. There's quite a few foundations funding things like that across the United States now because, again, I mean, even in museums and galleries, you see a real lack of diversity at any sort of higher staffing level. So if you don't see people that look like you in this industry, and when I went into fashion, I didn't know any other black women necessarily that were working in fashion other than Tracy Reese. She's a famous African-American designer. It didn't deter me, but when I went in, I also didn't see a lot of other brown or black women either, so...
I definitely think that's changing. If you came on our campus any day of the week, you would see that we are very diverse.
Are you diverse?
Absolutely. Yeah. And what the people I see working in the industry, locally anyway, are equally diverse.
Right. Yeah. Thank you so much for your call, Margie. Well, I must say that, you know, I watch the Academy Awards. I watch them every year because it's this shared experience. But last night, because I knew both of you were going to be with us, I was seeing all of this in a completely different way. I mean, I was thinking about the great care that was taken for all of those gowns and the beads and the sewing on pearls and the sense of style and how they presented. And I must say, I really appreciated it so much more, whereas before I would just sort of discount, well, you know, they got another gown on. But the whole world of design, I realized how important it is to that world of Hollywood, too. But just in terms of the art of all of it, I mean, there was a great beauty in the way some of these were made and the way they looked on
but
people.
But one of the big differences in the Academy Awards is most of those celebrities borrow their clothes, and they're supposed to give them back. The stories go that sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. What was unique about Eunice Johnson and what really gave her entree into these designers' studios is that she purchased each and every one of those outfits, whether it was ready to wear or couture, at whatever the price was. Now, she may have purchased a runway dress, and when we see those couture shows, just by their very nature, if they're going down the runway, they're never sold. Those are just samples, like Eunice Johnson, because they have to be customized to a particular customer. So some of the things we see down a couture runway never see the light of day. Nobody ever buys half of the things that go down the
Interesting.
Yeah.
And there was a big charity part of what she did, too, for these shows. They raised money, didn't they, for charities?
Yeah, over the 50 years, they raised over $50 million
for
black charities and organizations across the country. So that's one of the reasons today why this show isn't still going on. It stopped in 2009, and that's in the spring of 2009, because it just became, it wasn't viable anymore. It was a very expensive effort to put on, and even though they were partnering with these organizations in, you know, cities across the United States, so when it came to like Mount Mary's campus, it was the Cream City chapter of the Lynx, which is a black female philanthropic organization that were sponsoring it. And I believe they gave a scholarship to a student every year it was on that campus. So Eunice Johnson charged these groups that she's working with to still provide funding, scholarships, whatever to, you know, to the community. But once we got to 2008 and we had the crash, and publishing has always, you know, had been taking a hit anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
They were losing too much money, you know.
Right. All right, for those who have not seen, and it's early in its run, this terrific show, why don't you just, both of you, think for, I don't know how many, we have about 2 minutes left, items that are very, very important to see that are revolutionary in some way and that you can't miss when you look at all of them.
When you say items, you mean particular gowns or?
Gowns or a suit or whatever, things that you just are, that you as curator go to every day and just stand in front of it and you say, I really like this.
You know, I am a real fan of the unconventional wedding gowns in the show. Every time I take people on a tour and I say, oh, this Bob Mackie with the long ostrich coat and the the see-through, whatever, crystal beaded dress and hat, like, that's a wedding dress. And they're like, what? That's a wedding dress? It's impossible. And it's just, I love that imagination that makes people really think outside of what is, you know, normal as far as a wedding dress goes, or the wonderful ready-to-wear that we get even more examples of through Mount Mary University's sponsorship and sharing these garments with us. You see just stunning, I mean, when I say ready-to-wear, that's like everyday wear, sportswear. But it's still, like, fantastic. So even if you're wearing normal clothes, you should be able to look, you know, pick out the best things. Don't just wear a regular sweatshirt. Wear a sweatshirt with beading on it or something if you want to still be comfortable and stylish.
Yeah. Sandra, how about you?
I love the Jeffrey Bean that is in our portion of the collection. It looks so simple. It's black with tan or nude-colored fabric in some of the key places, but the seams are so flawless. I mean, it looks simple, but if you know anything about sewing with jersey, the fact that those seams are so straight and not a pucker in them, it's just a gorgeous dress. And then I also like that gray suit, and I'm trying to think with the hood, the fur-trimmed hood, and it's sort of smocked at the waist. It's a long skirt, I believe.
Oh, yeah, that's Jean Galliano.
It's Galliano.
For Dior, I believe.
And yeah, there's something, it looks like a snow queen.
Yes, it's perfection.
It's really
it's
perfection.
Warm and comfy.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh. And the show runs how long?
It runs through May 3rd at the Milwaukee
Art
Museum.
Good. So it's got a good long run ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And thank you both so much. I feel like this whole new world is open to me at my advanced age, and that's a good thing. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
It was great. Camille Morgan. Camille is curator of the program. She's an independent curator and arts administrator, and we had the great pleasure of touring this wonderful exhibit with her. And also, Sandra Kaiser, you got to see Mount Mary's influence here, too. She is the chair of the fashion department at Mount Mary University, and they have a huge collection of historic costumes and had many of these shows on the Mount Mary campus for many years. So thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production, and he's looking fine today, nicely dressed. For on-air production here as well. Please join us tomorrow for our program. The four previous teachers of the year will join us, hour one.